Thank you all for showing up on time. This is the Lesage and Outdoor Heritage Council meeting, November 13th, 2016. We have a long agenda today. And we have Jenny and Elizabeth who are going to join us by phone. They cannot vote because they didn't give weeks' notice, but they can participate with comments and listen under our current understanding of the open meeting. So, are Denny or you and Elizabeth on?
I'm on.
Elizabeth is on. Denny isn't. So, we'll get going. Thank you, Elizabeth. Just so everyone knows, Elizabeth made valiant efforts to be here. She got 10 miles from home and had not found pavement, but only found ice and decided she was going home. So she wanted to be here, especially for Village Party, but couldn't. So thanks for joining us by phone.
We have
the agenda in front of us. I take a motion for approval of the agenda. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. You have the minutes of our last meeting. I'd love a motion to approve.
So move.
Any discussion, corrections? All in favor of approval?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Any conflicts of interest that anybody wants to disclose that are not already of record? Anything new that's come up since the last time? If not, we'll move right to the Executive Director's Report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two items I'd like to report on and get some input on. One is we've attached a draft 2015 Council schedule in the packet. It's behind the 2014 schedule. I wanted to bring that to your attention and ask for any input now or for the staff at the next meeting. This 2015 agenda will be reviewed and approved by the new council, which will be a January or February meeting. But I think that your input at this point is wise, and we can straighten out some potential conflicts, perhaps. So with that,
Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping that the September hearings, which are obviously three of our more important days, which is scheduled here for the 9th, 10th, and 11th of Labor Day week, so we're off. I was hoping that we could take not out on the short week and possibly move it to 16, 17, and 18.
All right.
And we will attempt to do that. And that will cause some changes in the deadline on the 24th and maybe the 13th time. But we'll take care of it as best we can.
Are there any objections to trying to accomplish that to accommodate Tom's schedule? So if you would put together a revised, if staff would put together a revised preliminary schedule and send it out to everyone so we can get it in our calendars as soon as possible, that would be great. Scott?
And I don't know if this is just me, but you take a look at the 15 schedule and there's a whole bunch of Friday meetings in there. I mean, if those could be any other day on Friday, I think you would have a higher attendance rate of the council overall. I mean, people make plans for the weekend. You know, you leave Friday after work. Friday at noon, you're gone. I mean, to me, Fridays are much more difficult to make than, say, a Thursday or a Wednesday.
I think the Fridays are all while the session is taking place, and the problem is we can't meet while they're in session, and they're typically in session Monday through Thursday and take a day off on Friday, which is why we scheduled it for Friday. That's my recollection as to why it got there. I mean, it'd be a good one.
And if it ends up being on Friday, I just assume it'd be Friday at 8 o'clock. Instead of, I mean, for me, a noon meeting, you know, it's just a morning meeting is an easier deal for people to drive a long ways. Okay, so if they end up having to be Fridays, which I prefer they don't, then we'll work around that, but assuming that I'll be attending anyway. But if they were in the morning, that would still be better than 1 o'clock. Now, that's not just for those. That's for any meeting. Starting at 8, being done at 1 or 2 is better, in my opinion, than starting at 1 o'clock and getting done at 5.
Okay. Any other thoughts? Ron?
I see in November the meeting is scheduled for Thursday again during the Minnesota firearm deer season. That's almost sacrilegious. Could it be
obviously works for you.
It'll be the 19th, possibly.
November 19th? My gut feel is that it could, and if we're going to move the 16th, 17th, and 18th, back from the 9th, 10th, and 11th on September, it might be better for staff to be moving the whole schedule back by a week.
Don't move the October one.
What's that?
Don't move the October one.
I think if we move September, we almost have to move October. We'll talk about this in
That's
January.
Okay. That's
okay. So we'll get a revised draft out.
And we'll put some times on it, too, so that we can be looking at what times they are as well. All right?
The other item, Mr. Chair, I would like to address is one of the members requested that an investigation of the Wild Rice River Project, that's the White Earth Nation Project, doing that in concert with DNR be investigated. I have a letter that was delivered today before the meeting. In short, I would say that the letter from the Tribal Council identifies that DNR is considering whether or not they can do it. But the Tribal Council objects to the change on the basis of they're the ones that came up with the project. They brought it to us. It's their ownership, and they don't think that it ought to be changed, the way I read the letter. This is something that will not be addressed until we get to the language in December. We have a representative, I believe, of a tribe in DNR, if you want to have testimony.
Do we want testimony? There's the letter sufficient. Letter is fine.
And that's the executive director report.
Yes. On another matter, I think at the last meeting, I asked about cropping, look at rider language on cropping issues relating to particles. And I know that's not included in what we're going to be looking at today. So this can be a discussion on that request.
If you look at item 10, I think we'll have that discussion then. Is that okay with you?
Under E?
Yep. Under E. All right. So we'll do that. Any other questions for Bill? All right, let's move into number 5, approval of transfer of land acquired under ML 2011, Tucson Limited Project wanting to transfer their property to the U.S. Forest Service.
We have an agenda item memo that contains the statutes that we're working under. It contains a suggested motion and procedure. And it contains attachments, including an email from DU, a letter from the Forest Service, a new state parcel map, a letter notifying the legislative chairs and leadership, reference to LSOHC procedures on how to handle this, Ducks Unlimited of Bowser DNR Wildlife Project. So what we're doing here is under a prior appropriation in Minnesota laws of 11, Ducks Unlimited purchased a piece of property in St. Louis County, and they prefer not to hold property, but to find an appropriate managing entity in the area to manage the property for the purposes that the council intended the property to be purchased for. There's a procedure they must go through. The first step in that procedure is to get the recipient to acknowledge they're receiving it and want it, and agree to the terms and conditions. And then they need permission from the council. The council, by law, has to notify chairs and minority members of the committees dealing with the Outdoor Heritage Fund. We cast a wide net. Those letters are found, attached. And with that, Mr. Schneider is here with Ms.
Mr. Chairman, Council Members, John Schneider, Manager of Conservation Programs for Ducks Unlimited. With me is Liz Schleif, Realty Specialist with the Superior National Forest, and behind me is Dan Ryan, Wildlife Biologist with the Superior National Forest. We're here to answer any questions as Mr. Becker outlined. This is a good news story. We were successful in our acquisition of the last remaining privately owned parcel on Moose Lake, which is a highly productive, highly sensitive wildlife lake in St. Louis County, north of Virginia. This land was privately owned, and the owner had it for sale, was in the process of providing it into lots and selling it, but was interested in conserving it as well. And we successfully appraised it and negotiated the purchase price based on that appraisal this spring, in June, before our 2011 appropriation for Wildrice Lake Shoreland Protection concluded. So we're now in the process of doing our final report, and we will submit that final report once this parcel has transferred and been conveyed to a public land management entity. Ducks Unlimited does not desire to own and manage land, especially this small parcel up north. And so we explored options, including St. Louis County, Minnesota DNR, and U.S. Forest Service. And following the council's strategic plan of consolidating forest ownership and management, it made sense, as you can see from the maps, that this parcel be transferred to the U.S. Forest Service. The Forest Service expressed interest in owning and managing this parcel in large part to protect Moose Lake, to their credit, not because they want to harvest the trees, but to protect the lake and provide public recreational opportunities, including hand harvesting of wild rice, as well as waterfowl hunting and deer hunting. They provided us with that assurance in the spring. We acquired the parcel in June, and now they've supplied us with a letter agreeing to accept the transfer of the land with your permission and to follow all the OHF statutory guidance. And with that, we'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Questions? Scott?
Me and Bob had the same question. Does the service own all the other property that surrounds us?
Chair, Schneider, who are the adjacent landowners around the Forest Service that owns all of the land, or will own all of the land around the lake?
Mr. Anderson, Chairman Hartwell, and members, The map indicates all the green land is owned by the U.S. Forest Service. There is still some potlatch land in the surrounding area around the U.S. Forest Service land. I think there's one other private landowner as well.
I have a couple questions. Thank you. And I'll start with how far north of the north side of the Nuntak tailing basin is it? Is it like 2 or 3, 4 miles north?
Probably 3 or 4 miles.
Okay. And have there been any sulfate studies done in that water?
Not that I'm aware of. Maybe 1854.
And these pictures of the rice were when?
The pictures included the aerial photo was a couple of years ago. I'm not sure about the first one.
So
on the back page there, it's 2007-2009. It is my understanding this lake has a consistently good wild rice crop on it.
My main concern is that having the federal government own and manage land, that they adopt and enforce Minnesota rules for hunting, trapping, any kind of taking, fishing, just like any other OHF money that we'd want to have. I think didn't we run into a problem with another federal entity and a conflict with Minnesota laws versus federal laws? Isn't it Minnesota Valley something?
Oh, that was the management of it.
The management, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure that it's managed in perpetuity the way that OHF acquisitions always have been, and that's our intent.
I think what you're referring to is a refuge versus Forest Service, and the refuge has
different
specific...
That's right.
You have to have some of it that's really a refuge and a refuge.
Right. I just want to make sure that this is managed in accordance with Minnesota laws, so that it would be just like any other OHF acquisition, so the taxpayers and public has access like it would anywhere else in the state on state land.
Mr. Chair, Councilwoman Kingston and members, it's my understanding this land will be open to public hunting and managed according to state game regulations.
And taking of all kinds and fishing too, not
yes,
just hunting.
Mr. Chair, I might refer members to the letter in the packet that's from Ms. Holler, the Forest Supervisor, that should address most of those concerns.
Good.
Agreed.
In writing.
Okay. Perfect.
Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about, is this going to be another piece of property up there in the boondocks just kind of sits there? Under federal ownership, you mentioned the word management. Do you have any idea what kind of proactive management you will apply to this parcel?
I'm going to defer that question to Dan Ryan for his insight into management.
Mostly it's going to be used for recreational access to the lake. We'll probably have a campsite there, and it kind of was the previous access to the lake, but then when it was bought, it was gated off, so we put in another access. So mostly it's going to be recreational use for duck hunting, wild hunting, and trapping.
Mr. Chair, we're talking about acquiring an access, or is there some management you could do, or doesn't it need any proactive duck management, rice management, wildlife management, you name it?
Well, this will be the land. I mean, the lake, we do cooperate with the DNR as far as doing water level management for the rice on that lake. So the lake's in pretty good shape that way. It's kind of prevented development from happening there, which could have had some impacts on the wild rice.
All right. Do you want to make a motion?
So moved.
You're moving
the suggested motion in the packet.
All right. The suggested Motion is to move to approve the transfer of the 28-acre parcel, moved to St. Louis County, U.S. Department of Agriculture Forest Service. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank the council and make a note that this is the first, as far as I'm aware, this is the first parcel purchased and transferred to the U.S. Forest Service with Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars. So we're paving some new conservation ground here in a positive way.
Thank you. Treat it well. Next, item six, the discussion of an approval, a request for approval of an amendment of ML 2014, accelerated protection of grassland and prairie habitat with RIM and National Prairie Bank easements. Welcome.
Good afternoon. For the record, Dave Shedd with me is Deputy Commissioner of DNR, looking at Jason Garham, who oversees our prairie bank program. I believe there is some background information in your packet here on this parcel. Just a very short history is it's a 160-acre tract. Pretty high priority for protection from a prairie standpoint. We kind of had our eye on it for a number of years. First approached the landowner back in 2009, bought a prairie bank easement. They weren't interested at that time. Since then, one of our NGO partners approached them with interest in purchasing the land in fee title as a scientific and natural area. Went ahead and got an appraisal for that acquisition, and the landowners recalled the contact that they had with our prairie bank staff and reached back out to our staff just to ask whether we would still have interest in it from a prairie bank standpoint, and if so, what the payment would be. And what we learned was that the formula that we use to value prairie bank parcels came up with a value that was significantly higher than the appraised value. This is actually one of the very rare circumstances where we have both a current appraisal and a valuation based on the formula, and it pointed out some issues related to the use of the formula. And so I'm talking with Bill and staff. Thought it would be a good idea to come here and talk a little bit about formula and evaluation process. So I'm going to hand it over to Jason. He's going to talk a little bit about the parcel, walk through the history of the formula and how it works and what it is about this parcel that is perhaps unique in regards to the formula, and then we can open it up for next steps. I should just mention that the current status of the parcel, we do have an option to purchase the conservation easement. We have not elected to purchase that yet, take that next step to purchase that. We did extend the option so that we did have a chance to come here and have this conversation before we made a final decision on whether to go ahead and purchase the parcel based on the formula. And should also know that if we do elect not to purchase the property at this point, the landowners would be $500, I believe, Jason. We would have to compensate them for pulling out of that option to purchase. So with that as just brief background, we'll turn it over to Jason.
Chair and council members, as Dave mentioned, this property is particularly appraised that we're on our radar as far as prairie protection for some time. It was first identified by the Missouri Biological Survey in the late 90s, the first time we approached them about protection options in the prairie bank was, as they mentioned, 2009. where our prebank rates, which follow market values, were less than half of what they are today, considering what has happened with land value, particularly in that region of the state. In 2009, they were not interested in the easement at that time. And as we often do, we hold on to that contact and try it at a later date and see if their situation has changed and if they might be interested in the future. It's common to do that. More recently, the Green Corridors Project approached us and said, we have some environmental natural resource trust fund dollars. We're looking for potential sites. You have something, we could acquire and turn over to you as an SMA. This was one of those sites we provided to them. They were able to take the project almost up to closing, which involved getting an appraisal. The landowners then came back and said, what about appraising? And we try hard to run a very transparent and fair, equitable application process with Prairie Bank. And so we were obligated to let them know they're certainly eligible. They score quite high, and we do have some funding to match them. And so they decided that actually the Prairie Bank offer worked better for them than the offer Green Corridors could give them. But a portion of the Green Corridors situation where they had to make that investment, unfortunately. But, so that's kind of led us up to this point. We have this project right in the queue for our most recent the Heritage Fund appropriation, our laws of 14 appropriation just received. The good news there with this project included in the mix of those other projects we have in the queue, we're on track to deliver about 900 acres of easements where our deliverables more like 600 in the work program. So we're set to kind of exceed our goals for this particular project. And more on to the formula side of things, there's a handout that I hopefully made its way around where we try to point out how formula is used and where it comes from. Formula is established in statute. We pay 65% of the RIM rate for cropland in that particular township. So another way to look at that number is it's about 58.5% of what ag land value is doing in that particular township. And the reason we like the formula, we think the formulas work well, is it's as opposed to other means of evaluation, it's much faster, and over a period of time through the program, it's saved us money and does reflect what's happening in the marketplace. It's the data that's used to provide a information. It's a little kind of schematic bottom of the bell curve, if you will, on that. Tries to show where how the formula might work over a long period of time, and that you do with a formula-based system run the risk of you might undercompensate, on occasion you might be slightly overcompensating. But if you look over a long period of time and across geographic distribution, an example of that is right within this appropriation we're considering. We're on track to over-deliver acres in one of those projects. And it has been of value to us as well as we have other conservation entities out there who are ambassadors for our program. When we have a rate sheet for this township by township saying this is our payment rate. It allows those other entities to approach landowners on our behalf and try to understand the program. It also allows the landowners right up front in that application to decide whether that is going to work for them or not. It essentially reduces our failure rate at, almost zero for those that come in. Maybe you're interested in they can see right up front. They can take that number, work with their attorney, the tax consultant, whoever they want to consult, and know that that's going to work for them. It shaves often 3 to 6 months off the process. And when we're talking about volumes of projects, I'm going to be able to do those efficiently, the formula works well.
Okay. Good question?
No.
Good.
My question is, we're looking at the second page and the evaluation factors, and it mentions the landowner currently rents out to a grazer. Is that going to continue?
We're not sure whether they will actually continue to rent out to that grazer. They have the choice of whether they want to continue grazing rights or not, and whether they want to continue renting to that same individual. I would have to check if we actually see what the landowner's specific interests are.
Well, what would the easement say?
I'd have to look. I don't believe the landowner. My recollection, again, I'm more than willing to look into the back of the books. My recollection is that this landowner is not likely to retain grazing rights.
Mr. Chair, if the landowner does retain the grazing rights, do they have to follow a grazing plan, or do they just continue to graze?
Chair and council members, good question, and if they would certainly have to follow that, built right into the terms and conditions of the easement, they have to follow a grazing plan that's approved by the department.
And value would be diminished also based on that grazing agreement.
Mr. Chair, I think that's the question. So we're going to be providing more public money than. We've got two programs that have different rates. One is an acquisition and one's an easement. So there's a significant difference in the value. So the public purpose is to protect the prairie, but if the landowner retains the private profit and is getting a pretty sweet deal on this, I think there's a precedent there that is going to come back and bite us in the long run. We are extremely explicit in the easement or having clear that there's a that grazing is allowed only for management purposes, and there's a clear diminishment of the value. Okay. I think you're saying this, but I think we just keep opening up an issue here that leads to subsidized grazing and high value.
Yeah. Thanks, David. Jason, I wonder if you could explain again on this formula. So, really, with this formula, that the price of that land would have to drop almost 50% within a year for the acquisition price to be higher than the or lower than the easement cost. Is that right?
Chair and council members, I have to kind of follow the math, but I think I know where you're going. And yeah, it's a substantial drop there. What's happened in this situation is it's in a township where the tillable ag land is selling extremely high. This is one of the few parcels that has not been plowed. It is why we're interested. It's a rare and unique native prairie. The appraisal is going to try and find comparable sales. There's not much like it out there. The parcel also does have some wetlands to convert it, to drain it, because those things will trip some WACA concerns and things like that. So that's the kind of stuff that goes into appraising that property. So we have no reason to believe that the appraisal is off. It's just from an economic standpoint, the valuation is low. From a conservation value standpoint, this is one of the last wet saline prairies in this part of the Madison County. So it's a pretty high conservation
value. Good afternoon. Two questions I have for you. Mr. Shad, you said that if the individual retains the grazing rights, that the value goes down. So that how much does our easement payment rate go down if he retains grazing rights? And number two is, we hear all the time that you know, we have far more interested people than we have money or funds to acquire. My question would be is, do we have other parcels where the individual would not retain grazing rights that could be acquired instead of parcels where the owner does retain grazing rights? That's a two-part question.
Certainly, and I to Chair and council members, the the price per acre that we've quoted so far, this payment rate in this township of Gray makes $3,815. Mm-hmm. That is the full payment rate where they would not retain any uses in the future, such as grazing or seed harvesting. That leads me to believe that this is likely one of the landowners not interested in retaining grazing rights. They're interested in that full payment. I couldn't say that for certain. I'm more than willing to check on that and get back to the members on that. But they would, if they did decide to retain grazing, it is an option. We would entertain it. The reduction in the payment is usually somewhere around 15-20%. And the reason I say it's around that, it's based on another formula that Steve Zapp of the university helped us to develop, where we look at what the economic generation might be, how much profit would they make over the next 30 years by continuing to graze. So it looks at indices like 30-year bond rate, average pasture rental, and it builds those things into a formula. So we can update that annually, too, to reflect exactly what's going on in the market. So if that's a positive reduction, we can look up that number and have it in front of me, but we can know by township what that there are other properties out there where we have landowners interested in the full tank not retaining grazing or the seed harvesting. What we do is we have an evaluation process, a scoring process, and those criteria established in this sort of rule. So we look at a project based on, you know, its ecological value. This one scores out of a potential 100 points, it scores 87. So it does score quite well compared to a lot of projects we have.
So I might just also add, in many cases, you know, the timing has to be right in order to be able to step in and protect the rare parcel. It's in 2009. The timing wasn't right. It just so happens because of this family's circumstances right now that the timing is right now. And so I think that plays into the equation here, too. If we forego this opportunity to protect it at this time, we may not have another chance anytime in the foreseeable future as circumstances change for us. I think it's the sons and daughters that we're dealing with right now, and they need to make some decisions about what they want to do with this, with the family farm, basically.
So, Scott?
One last follow-up. You know, and I understand how hard it is to get. I mean, we want to try to protect those at every turn. You know, you indicated that the rate, the easement rate is set by statute, okay? And then you calculate what the economic benefit of the grazing is, and then we reduce that. Okay, is that formula used to determine the economic benefit of grazing? Is that also in statute? I mean, to me, I would say it's $3,800 an acre if you don't graze it, and it's $2,000 an acre if you do. I mean, is that secondary rate with the grazing right on it? Is that something we decide, or is that something that is also determined in statute? Because to me, we could say it's $3,800 if you don't graze it, and it's $2,000 if you do. I mean, we could make a gigantic economic incentive to, you know, not do that. Do we have that option?
Yeah.
Would you exercise that option?
All right, Danny, thank you.
David, I'm going to have a tough time. My phone actually went dead, so I'm going to try to be on for a little while, and then I'm going to have to call back, and I apologize.
Okay. Thanks for making the effort.
Sorry. I'll listen. I'm going to mute my phone and listen.
Chair and council members, to address the question of how much is established in statute as far as reductions for grazing and how to go about that. The statute is very specific about 65% of the rim rate established by Bowser. It goes on to say the department may consider continued agricultural uses of the property without specifying exactly what that formula is. The department has that ability. It's about as far as specific as the statute gets. We decided many years ago to actually approach the university and Dr. Taft to help us with how we figure that out. it is a formula also that's worked pretty well. It follows what the market was doing when rental rates on pasture land go up. You know, we followed the
formula. You had a follow-up, and I cut you off.
I have another question. Jane, let's go first.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that the comparators that you were answering Scott's question with, are those also the wet saline type of native prairie bank? Did they score at 87s also?
Chair and council members, the other projects we may have in the queue.
Yeah, that don't have the grazing issue?
Yeah, the sites that may not have, or the lander may not want to retain grazing rights. I would have to look at
right.
What I can say is, right now, in our list of projects that's ranked from the highest scoring down, the highest scoring project right now is 87. I think there's a second site in there that's close to 87, if not 87. The next sites are right down in about 80.
I just wanted to follow up with my opinion on this is that grazing is a concern. I think we should talk about it and the value should reflect. But I also think it's imperative that we jump on these opportunities and these family sales when you've got multiple family members in them. They can walk away from them if you look at them cross-eyed, and I don't want to have that happen. I mean, this is a valuable acquisition, and I believe that the rigorous process that DNR follows in terms of its selection and its financing, not just the sale price of the easement, but the grazing, I say go with it. This is one of the most important things that we're doing, this native prairie bank.
Jason, could you just give a description to us of the last easement you did that grazing was allowed on? Could you tell us how much grazing was allowed and what the discrepancy in costs were on the last easement that you did?
Certainly. Chair and council members, I wish we had another hour to go into the grazing. There's so much we could talk about. Someday we'll have to unpack all of that. I'll try to be succinct. Brief. What we look at is our guiding principle for what the grazing plan will include. We typically are cutting the stocking rate back almost half of what they would have been used to using. And we build in a strong rest rotational pattern. So it more closely mimics what a nomadic bison herd might have done. So it's short periods of grazing with longer periods of rest built in. So its plants can fully recover, rebuild their tissue, and do all the things that they need to do, and have improved habitat value there as well. So our grazing plans are a little different than many of them out there that are more production-oriented. These are for the management of the prairie and secondarily to sell some beef. So our grazing plans are also pretty hefty in trying to mitigate invasive species issues, both moving them around on site, moving new ones in on site, things like having to flush the cows for 2 weeks prior to they come on site. They have to sit somewhere else and eat wheat, gray, hay for 2 weeks before they come on. But we do a number of things like that. They're not necessarily the typical invasive plans.
And who monitors that, Jason?
We have field staff across the state that monitor that. Our prairie specialists, we have them in co-located offices, wind and furnace fall locations. One of their main primary responsibilities is working with these landowners to help develop those plans, implement those plans, and then part of our monitoring and enforcement protocols is also following up to ensure that those plans are developed.
Okay.
My question is the authority question. So I think you testified that based on the 38.15 as per acre of cost, that you assumed that there were no agricultural practices retained. And if we have a motion as a suggested motion, we're going to the dollar amount on that assumption. I would feel more comfortable if the motion had a caveat or had a clause that said the 38.15 an acre based on no agricultural practices being retained, or that there is a subsequent reduction dependent on approved management. I'm just uncomfortable authorizing based on the assumption when we don't know, and I agree with Jane that we want to move forward, but I when we're going to 3815
no conditions
without that.
Yeah.
I don't want to approve something that then is not accurate based on the assumption. So,
Mr. Chair, that's consistent with our practice.
I've already written out what both of these guys were just talking about. I would move to approve the amendment to acquire the Wordland parcel under the appropriation at a cost of $38.15 an acre, subject to the condition that grazing or agricultural practices by the landowner be permanently discontinued and that any grazing be allowed only as determined by the DNR and a written conservation plan.
Okay, so we have a motion. Ron?
In the background here, I'm a little confused. It says there was an offer once to acquire a fee title to this, and then it doesn't say what happened to that offer. And if you were going to buy it today, fee title, what would the price per acre be? Do you have any idea?
The offer to acquire the fee title was by a third party. Green Corridors had made that offer with the intent that after they acquired it, they would transfer it to the department to become an SNA. So they conducted an appraisal meeting our standards and made the offer based on that. That appraisal is not public information. It's not a number I have in front of me or the chair's idea.
Project manager here who can come down to talk about it if you'd like.
Well, you can infer it from the paragraph. If the paragraph says it's 38.15 and the other one was 140%, this is 140% higher, you can infer that the other one was, what, 2,600 or 2,800 or something like that.
I'm just mentioning if you want to hear from the project.
So we're suggesting we pay more for a easement than outright acquiring. Is that what I'm hearing?
That is what you're hearing, and that's because the acquisition of fee was based on an appraisal. The acquisition of easement is based on a formula of the average value of the land in the township. This being prairie, it doesn't have the same value as the formula applies.
Well, in the comparison that Ron's making, assumes that the land is actually for sale for fee title, and it doesn't appear that it is. Okay, so if you could buy it, we probably would buy it. If you can't buy it and you want to protect prairie, the second choice is an easement, and that's the rates that we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, maybe I just add at this point. There has been a lot of discussion about valuation of conservation easements. Appraisals are expensive, they're uncertain because the landowners don't commit to the project until after they see the value, and by that time you've spent $5,000 or $10,000 on an appraisal. And trying to appraise an easement with these different rights that you're purchasing or not purchasing can be difficult and certainly imprecise. And so I think a lot of us believe that going the appraisal route, especially in a lot of these small conservation easements, doesn't make a lot of sense. Formulas have a lot of benefit, but in cases like this, and we think they're pretty rare, they don't work out real well. And so we have had some conversations with Board of Law and Soil Resources, Sarah Strawman and John Jasky. We would like to convene a group of folks from the agencies, perhaps from a few of our NGO partners, to just explore some possible additional options for evaluation of conservation easements. Maybe something that is not as expensive, not as time-consuming as an appraisal, but something that is able to account for situations like this. We're not sure what that looks like. We'll take a look at maybe what some other models I don't know there. But we have the same concern. Certainly the legislature has provided us this direction to use this formula for this program. If there's a better another way to do it. We really need to take a look at that and see if we can determine that. So we will be pulling a group together here in the next month or two and hopefully bring back some recommendations to the legislature for their consideration.
Okay, did you have more? Jim?
Thanks, David. So if the DNR walked away, took their easement off and walked away, do you think the landowner would sell to the Green Corridor?
Possible to say. We're not sure.
Why wouldn't we take that approach, Dave?
Well, again, we haven't made a final decision. We do have an option to purchase. We can re-enter negotiations with this landowner. And that could take many forms. It could be that we withdraw that, pull out of that option, and instead offer a fee title option. It could be that we offer them the conservation easement, but ask them to donate some value, perhaps loan to that fee title appraised value. We've got some options here that we'd like to explore. We haven't started those discussions with the landowner. We wanted to have this conversation.
Can I make a couple of comments?
I just want to. This is terribly concerning to me that an easement would be valued at more than the title. It's not reality. It is a formula that's driving this. I spent a lot of time figuring out how to accredit land trusts, and the only way you
can... Denny's back.
Okay, Denny, thanks. The only way you can be accredited is if you have an appraisal. And part of the reason for that is if a nonprofit pays more, significantly more than what the value is, they're providing inurement to a private party, which can jeopardize their tax status. You can lose your 501c3 tax status for doing exactly what the state is going to do in this case. There is no way the landowner can donate the value of part of the easement here because there is no value. It's a fictitious thing. The appraisal establishes value. A formula does not establish value. You can't go to the landowner and say, donate X percent of the value of the easement which we were going to pay you, because the IRS won't allow it. So, this is just wrong. This deal is wrong. I'm sorry. I want to see the land protected, but we should not be facilitating the payment for less than full ownership. Greater than what that whole ownership is worth. It sets a horrible precedent that I don't believe we should go forward with, despite the value of the prairie, and nobody here is more in favor of protecting the prairie. But the formula doesn't work here, and the formula in general scares me because of these kinds of circumstances. I cannot support this as much as I want to.
Mr. Chair, a question I would have for you is you don't support the formula on this particular parcel, or because this formula is going to work out this way on virtually every prairie easement that's ever done. If you did 10 more of these, they're all going to look exactly the same. So basically what we have to say, we have a well-established prairie bank program that's been in existence since 1987 using some form of formula to acquire. Okay, we're not necessarily acquiring it, even at those rates, at a pace that is protecting native prairie. So, if we truly go with that thought process, then the entire native prairie bank program and the formula it uses crashes and burns. And so is your discomfort on this parcel or on the entire native prairie bank program?
I would say it's certainly on this parcel. I would guess, and I'm no expert on the formula, but in a declining market that we're seeing today, that the formula is going to do exactly what you're saying, and you're going to be paying last year's valuations and assessments for this year's value, and it's wrong. In an increasing market, it's equally bad because you can't keep up and you're underpaying. And formulas don't work. We don't believe formulas work well, but I don't know how, I know this has taken place for a long time. I don't know how we can sit here and have the evidence that we would be paying 40% more than fee titles and approve it. I just don't think you can do that. I can't do that. Sue?
I agree that it doesn't really make sense, but the statute is the one that sets the formula. We don't set the formula. If the landowner says, I'm not going to sell because the sale price is lower, how dumb am I? I'm going to go with the statutory formula. If we want it, we're going to pay the premium and get the easement. There aren't very many pieces like this around, and when you've got kids fighting over what to do with it, those kids are just looking to get the money out, and it's going to get plowed up and it'll be gone forever. I don't think 3815 is that bad compared to what I've seen in southern Minnesota for farmland. And I, even though it doesn't make sense compared to the acquisition cost, we can't acquire it because they're not going to sell for that. And I think we would be better off with just doing it. And then maybe asking the Congress here to House and Senate to take a look at the statute and see if they can come up with something that makes more sense for the next time.
Jim?
Oh, I think the other thing, too, David, is this Prairie Bank program is really the backbone of the DNR's prairie recovery, which we funded, and we've been asked to fund it more generously. And, I mean, I agree with you 100%. If this is our tool for saving the prairie, we got serious issues.
Questions?
Sure.
All right. The DNR is generally bound to appraisals for acquisition, or else if it's going to be 10% over, they have to get special approval. Does this same rule apply for easements, or should it?
Mr. Chairman and Patty, this is Dave Schatz. The formula for the Native Prairie Bank program, the formula is the formula, and that's the offer. We don't have the opportunity to adjust that upwards or negotiate anything about that. We could certainly ask the landowners if they would accept something less than that, and that might be a possibility here in this case. But we don't have that same opportunity that we do with the title acquisition to negotiate something above the appraised value, up to 10%, or even higher than that, as long as there's offsetting bargain sales that equal at least the amount of dollars that we paid above appraised value over time.
So, to me, I hear what everyone's saying. There's no one that wants to do this type of deal more than me. If we don't pay above market value for an easement, it's going to be sold at market value to somebody. It sounds to me like we got somebody else who wants to buy it at market value. Whether or not the landowner would sell it at that because they're unhappy or can't reach a decision is an unknown. But it seems like there's another alternative for conservation there. And there's always another alternative because rarely will someone pay above market value for something when they're looking at getting an economic return. So I will not be unhappy if we approve this, but I can't personally vote to approve this. I would like to ask for an amendment to your motion that if it does go forward, that the DNR come back and tell us what happens. Make a report about that so we can get that information.
Okay.
Yeah, as well as what are you going to do next time so this doesn't just continually reoccur. If that would be acceptable. Scott?
Just one last kind of a procedural question. You know, if this motion would fail, and this landowner who has an eligible piece of property that scores really high is denied an opportunity to sell an easement, okay, how do we tell the next guy who has an eligible property with a high-scoring piece of native prairie art that yours qualifies and you, individual, don't? Okay, I mean this entire setup is here as a review for us only because the rate changed from what we first offered them. I mean, they probably did 40 more of these that are just like it that didn't end up in our purview. My question is, if this motion doesn't pass, how do you tell one landowner the formula works really good for those three people, but it doesn't work for you? I'm not sure that we can, in reality, do that. Now, we can work to change the formula. I think we should. I don't think we're in a position to deny this particular easement going forward because it got brought to our attention.
Ron,
well, the formula is, you know, kind of a figment of everybody's imagination. We have this whole thing turned upside down. If I wanted to buy this property, I would take the appraised value. Now, if he doesn't want to sell, then you say, okay, I would like to have an easement. This allows you to still own the land, but I want to pay for some control of it. It's preposterous to me that paying to control a piece of the ground would be cost me more than buying it outright based on this formula that you've come up with. And I would go back to the landowner and say, we'd like to buy it for whatever the going rate is. And if he says, no, I don't want to sell it for that, he says, well, how about an easement for something less than that? Certainly. Not more.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, the legislature has provided us the direction on how to value, and it's there in the law. We don't have that option to run our program outside of the direction provided by the legislature.
Are you talking about the easement value or
the formula is in statute. The formula was developed by the legislature, and that's the direction that they provided us on how we run our program.
Rick?
I'll ask for a roll call to give the opportunity to vote against the motion. I'm going to vote for the motion because I think that we're pretty much going beyond our ability, kind of on what Scott's saying. We're treating one differently than others based on the chance that it's in front of us. I understand, Ron, your frustration because we have a citizen who has found a loophole is not quite the right word, but it's a different opportunity within the same agency based on the programs that are available to them, and they're taking the better deal. And, you know, that's something that I don't think we correct by an amendment to accomplishment plan. I think that's something we would have to correct. But I completely understand the frustration. I am glad that we put some clauses on here. So that's why I'm going to roll call.
Just one other question. So when Green Quarters came to you and said they wanted to buy the land, okay, it was going to be purchased. Why did you come back then? And you already knew that. Why did you come back and offer them an easement?
Chair and council members, Green Quarters approached us and asked for, you know, any projects you may have that there's needs in which we could pursue and acquire, which eventually become an SMA. It was the landowner's choice before they decided, are we going to sell or not, to check back in with our program and say, it was 2009 last time we talked to you, We're just checking back in.
But you already knew they were going after that property, so why would you come out and say, yeah, well, we're interested in an easement?
Because we can't withhold that information.
That's well, not withholding information. You could say, no, we're not interested in an easement. Because we already know somebody's going to purchase it. They came to us and said, asked us for the information, and we gave it to them, so we knew they were pursuing it. Why would you step in and offer them an easement?
It wasn't without any discussion about what is the best way to handle this, certainly. And it goes a little bit to what Councilman Scott Rawl was saying. We have to, and we've tried to build a fairly equitable, transparent application process. So when an individual approaches us who has an eligible property that scores well and has all of those things, we have an obligation to tell them what you would score, would you be eligible, does the program have funding at the moment, and that's information that we have, you know, that we have to provide them.
This isn't your grandpa or something, is it? Okay.
So, Sue, would you accept my friendly amendment to your motion that DNR come back and report both on what happens with this as well as what they're going to do to address the issue generally?
Yes.
We have a motion on the table. Rick has asked for a roll call vote. Elizabeth and Denny can't vote. We call the roll.
Do we have the motions read again, please?
Sure.
I'll read my part. You can do yours. Move to approve the amendment to acquire the Wordland parcel under this appropriation at a cost of $38.15 an acre, subject to the condition that grazing or agricultural practices by the landowner be permanently discontinued and any grazing be allowed only as determined by the DNR in a written conservation plan.
Mine was that the DNR then come back and report on the outcome of this as well as what they are doing to look at the payment rate issue and the recommendations they might make, therefore.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Bob Anderson?
No.
Jim Cox?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Chair Hartwell?
No.
Jane Kingston?
Yes.
Sue Olson?
Yes.
Scott Rawl?
Yes.
Senator Satog?
Yes.
Ron Shara?
No.
That's 5 for yes and 4 for no.
Motion passes. Thank you for the discussion. I think it's a healthy discussion about a tough issue. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming. Next on the agenda is approval of amendments having to do with 2012 and 13 appropriations RIM WRP.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Council. I'm Sarah Froman, Acting Deputy Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. We are here, as you noted, to seek amendments to Phase 4 and Phase 5 of our legal URP programs and seeking approval of the accomplishment for Phase 6. I am here largely to provide a transition from the conversation that Greg Rajewski and I had with you in June to where we are now, and then with me is our conservation easement section manager, Bill Penning, and Tim Kohler, our senior programs advisor, is with us as well to answer any questions. So as I noted, we were here in June to provide an update on our WRP program, talk about a number of the changes that have taken place and a number of the challenges that we are now facing and moving forward with that program as originally proposed. Those issues included the escalating land crisis, we talked about that, the issues with federal budget situation and staffing shortages that NRCS is experiencing, and then lastly, the new Farm Bill, the 2014 Farm Bill that passed, and some differences in that Farm Bill from the previous one. We also discussed with you the importance of a private land strategy in meeting Minnesota's conservation goals and the key role that WIND plays in that private land strategy, as well as our commitment to ensuring that RIM retains that key role and remains to be a relevant program. You may also remember we were not ready at that time to move forward with our amendment board and approval of the Phase 6 accomplishment plan. We simply did not have enough specifics about how the 2014 Farm Bill would be implemented at that time. So while we discussed those issues generally, we weren't ready to move forward with specific requests. We are today, and so that's why we're here with these two amendment requests as well as the new accomplishment plan. One of the things that's happened in this intervening time is we have had continued conversations with NRCS and specifically with state conservation and standalone. And I believe in your packet there was an inclusion of a letter from Mr. Ballone to John Jaffe that outlined what we now know to be a number of elements that changed the way in which the Farm Bill easement programs are being implemented. And specifically, I'm referring to primarily the fact that the WRP program was eliminated in the 2014 Farm Bill, and a number of the easement programs were collapsed. Secondly, the overall funding provided to easement programs in the 2014 Farm Bill is vastly reduced from what we had in the previous Farm Bill. And maybe most importantly to the way we run our program now, in the past, Minnesota would receive an allocation for the state up front that then we could use to do a programmatic match with our state RIM program. They're no longer doing that. All of the applications are submitted into Washington into a national pool, and decisions are made across the country for which easement programs will be funded or which easement projects will be funded. And so what Mr. Ballone has outlined in his letter is that he now believes, based on the way these are going forward and because of that national pool, NRCS will now be focusing on projects that are big, fast, easy projects, not the kind of quality, complicated restoration projects that Director Jaffe and I shared with you back in June. And so that leaves us in a situation where we do not believe we will have opportunity to match program to program as we have in the past. It will be more unique case by case where their goals overlap with our goals. So with that, our approach going forward is to renew the focus on the RIM program. RIM has a long history of providing permanent protection in the state of Minnesota, and we will manage federal match where opportunities match with our goals. So we will retain a wetland focus. We're now wanting to call this the RIM Wetlands Program. We'll focus on that wetland, but we won't specifically tie it to a specific federal program. Rather, we will manage the match over time as those opportunities become available. I think we may have mentioned we're looking at specific opportunities like the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program or the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. It's some potential. We just don't know final decisions of those yet. We have a proposal in for the RCP and we're working on a proposal for the these changes and the transition from the RIM WRP to the RIM Wetlands Program have been discussed by the Bowser Board, and the Bowser Board has supported this transition by resolution. I believe that resolution is also included in your information. We've also discussed these changes with the board of the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. The Soil and Water Conservation Districts are our key partner in implementing the RIM program, and so we wanted to make sure we discussed these changes with them as well, and we had an opportunity to do so. With that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to Bill Penning to walk through where we're at with the amendment request specifically.
Good afternoon, Bill Penning, Conservation Easement Manager with Bowser. As Sarah mentioned, changes to the new federal Farm Bill have eliminated the WRP program, and therefore the RIM WRP partnership program must transition to the RIM Wetlands Partner Program. The elimination of WRP also changes the federal leverage that we have available, which I think is perhaps the crux of our issue today. And it also alters the number of acres that we'll be able to accomplish. The budget and output table changes have been made, and they're also in the narrative that we'll provide it to you. But before we dive into the details of that, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the successes that we had with RIM WRP. Through phases 1, 2, and 3, and half of phase 4, we were able to accomplish nearly 20,000 acres of permanent easements and wetland restorations using $33.5 million of outdoor heritage funds, and we leveraged $42 million in federal farm bill funds during that time. So while we had the opportunity to move, we moved as fast as we could, and we did as much as we could. And we like to think that the program was very successful while the opportunity was available. Some of the positive outcomes of that was that we maximized wildlife habitat potential by using a priority scoring system to ensure our base wildlife bank for the buck. We've used a spatial focus to build on existing habitat complexes. We've focused on expiring CRP to convert that to permanent protection. We've incorporated hydrology and secondary water quality benefits into our program. We promoted ecological diversity through providing pollinator habitat and other strategies. And we've also provided some positive economic benefits. According to a 2010 report done by NRCS that includes the economic benefits of RIM and WRP in Minnesota, $1.28 of the economic benefit was generated for every dollar that we spent. So just as your frame of reference here, we have been very successful with this program in the past. Unfortunately, those opportunities are no longer available to us. So specifically what we're doing in phases 4 and 5, we've reduced the leverage to reflect the absence of WRP, and the acres and the number of easements have also been reduced accordingly. We also scaled back personnel costs as we did that. Likewise, in phase 6, again, which is not an accomplishment plan amendment, this is the final accomplishment plan approval. In what we're submitting, we projected the number of easements and acres, assuming no federal leverage. Again, we may find opportunities via RCPP or CREP or some other source of funding to generate additional leverage. But at this point in time, we want to take a conservative approach to what we're proposing from here on in. So, under the proposed future conditions, there are some things that will work out, I think, to the better. When you work with a partner, you can only move at the rate at which the partner can move at, and you have to operate within their constraints, just like you have to operate within your constraints. Nonetheless, we feel that there's a very large backlog of willing landowners who want to get into a RIM wetlands program. Our local offices, through an informal survey, have reported nearly 100 interested landowners that want to move forward in this. We will continue to use our local delivery to the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, which is very cost-effective and has done an outstanding job to deliver this. In addition, we will continue to use the Ducks Unlimited partnership that you funded through these proposals. Faster. We will, if we go with RIM standalone, we will be able to close our easements faster. We will be able to get them done within 12 to 18 months, and actually we're shooting for under 12. That's our goal. We will be able to do our sign-ups, assuming that you approve our proposal today. We'll be able to do our sign-up and allocate the remaining funds early in 2015. We're shooting for perhaps a January sign-up. And at that time, we're looking at spending down the remainder of Phase 4, all of Phase 5, and all of Phase 6. And again, we want to continue the grim tradition for weapon restorations of trying to do very high quality weapon restorations in the places that they're needed, as opposed to just doing, you know, big and easy. So if you look at this as a package of the total of six phases, what we've already accomplished and what we're saying we're going to accomplish by the time we're done, we will have completed nearly 26,000 acres of wetland restorations and associated uplands, and $65 million of OHF dollars will have leveraged nearly $42 million of WRP. So in summary, we made the most of the RIM-WRP partnership while we could. It was very successful in its day. That partnership is no longer available to us, and we need to find a way to move forward. And we have a plan for you today to do that. We will continue to look for leverage, but we are, as Sarah said, restructuring RIM wetlands and actually all of the RIM programs to disassociate them from being tied to specific sources of funding so that we can manage opportunities as they come and go. And finally, I guess I'd like to remind you that RIM is the most important private lands program available to the state of Minnesota that we have through state functions. Over our nearly 29-year history, RIM has recorded nearly 7,000 easements on $264,000. I'm sorry, 264,000 acres. Yeah, 7,000 easements, 264,000.
So, Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to take any questions or thoughts that the council has. We realize that the reduction in leverage is not an easy conversation for you to have. This is not an easy conversation for us either. Please be assured of that. This was not the situation we hope to find ourselves in. We have brainstormed some other options that the council might be interested in. We'd be happy to talk about this based on your assessment.
Well, if you have options, why don't you lay them on the table?
All right, we would be happy to do that. Mr. Chair, I think one option that we could put on the table, it would be to extend the time frame of one or more of these private appropriations in order to give us time to see how our prep proposal plays out and whether there's a possibility to leverage that prep program. I think this is not really our preferred option. One, because it does not achieve our goal of getting the conservation on the ground in the timeline we'd like to and that we think we can do to stand in one room. Secondly, it ties us to another specific program with the match, which is what we're trying to get away from. I think the other option that we could try here is to see if we could generate some landowner match. And to, with this sign-up that Mr. Penny talked about, offer an option as a voluntary option for landowners. If they were willing to take less than the RIM rate, they would be given some kind of bonus point in the scoring. There would be mechanics we need to work through on that. We're not ready to discuss specifics today, but that would be something we would be willing to try with this next sign-up in order to see if it would be possible to generate some private match to the RIM programs.
Okay. Scott?
Ms. Payne, you guys have this map that came around? Okay. Yeah. As I listen to your proposal today, I don't think there's, you can go back and look at my record, I don't think there's really been a much bigger supporter of RIM-WRP than me. I funded this program handsomely in all of the years in which I could give it an appropriation. And you talk today about your priority scoring system and this huge backlog that you have of projects, you know, as we move into phase six and the rest. The map that you have in front of you now, the one with the blue line on it, do you see that?
Yes.
That was actually an approved RIM-WRP contract in Nobles County. Okay. It recently fell apart because the last landowner died, okay, and the family has exited that. So my question to you is if we have this really good priority scoring system and this giant backlog, why would we do a 106-acre RIM-WRP easement with 80 acres of that, over 80 acres of this map is going to be underwater. You know, I thought our priority systems, scoring systems, got us 4-1 upland versus wetland. Okay, I asked some local SWCD people, I said, how did we come up with this blue line? And they said the landowner drew that and it got approved. And I can tell you that I believe that we have done many great projects. This is not one of them. How could this project ever have gotten past this giant backlog of great projects and our super high priority scoring system when we have about a half an acre of upland to every acre of wetlands in this project? This to me is a horrible project. Tell me that the rest of them do not look like this.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know anything about this project, so I can't speak to any of the specifics on it.
I mean, but does your scoring system say that, in general, we get 4 acres of upland to 1 acre of wetland? That's our goal, right?
That is our goal, but some of it also depends upon what the landowner is willing to offer.
And so why would we not just pass up? If this project is 80 acres of water and 20 acres of upland, why would we? This is a flood retention project. Why would we just not have said pass on this one?
Again, I don't know the answer to that.
Is there any way that we can be assured that if we approve the accomplishment plans that you have in before us, and we're now moving into phase 6 with Rim Wetland, that we won't do any of these? We can be assured that we won't do any like this one. How do we as a council feel good about that?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Rawl, we can do our best in terms of scoring and ranking, and I don't know if under today's circumstances a project like this would have been approved. And I don't know the circumstances surrounding this. So all I can say is, you know, we can do our best. We have a scoring and ranking system.
Well, if we have a backlog of 100 landowners, I certainly hope we don't pick one of those 100 people that have a project where they draw the boundary and we say, yeah, we'll take that. Because this is not a good project.
Agreed.
Rick?
Well, I think that the challenge here is, and it's a bigger challenge than in front of council. We've had Room WRP, and we've had testimony in front of this council and what else, in front of legislative committees for several years. I understand the Farm Bill passing and the changes that are going on there, but the first amendment in front of us is to go back to 12 and 13, which are fiscal years prior to the Farm Bill being changed. And my memory could be wrong, but I think we had testimony saying that there was a match. And I think we had that testimony not just with other heritage, but we may have had a bonding money as well. So that's a problem. Yeah, that's a problem. Because if we make decisions based on the testimony that there's leverage. We didn't have any proposal in front of us this year because of the changes in the Farm Bill. And the Farm Bill, that the first year of the Farm Bill being changed, the upcoming amendment, that I can see. And I don't see that we have much of a choice here because if there's no money, there's no money. But we have ML 2012 and ML 13. We're being asked substantially change the outcome, which it appears that there is no other outcome than what happens here. I don't know what the proper word is for this, but it's not good because we've had the testimony saying
we're going to get this. We're going to get this extra money. And the farm bill that existed prior to that, yes, it didn't get renewed, but there is still money on the table. I think we asked, is there still money on the table that we can match? And the answer was yes. So maybe my memory is foggy here, but I don't think it is. Brian, can you explain that problem? Because that's, I think we're going to have to explain it a couple months again, too.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, and we have talked with Representative Kaufman in terms of the impact on bonding as well. One thing I will say, and then I think Mr. Penning can add to this, is I believe at the time that testimony was given, it was believed there would be match. It wasn't given on a false hope. It was believed there was match there in that current farm bill, and Mr. Penning can explain some of the factors that led to that match, no longer being there from the prior farm bill.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, there's a number of things that occurred here. One was that, again, we believed that NRCS was going to come through with the match. They told us they were going to come through with the match. They had come through with the match for three prior appropriations, so we had no reason to not believe that that was going to happen. Over time, though, the amount of money that NRCS had available began to decline. There wasn't a whole lot that they could do up even towards the end of the last farm bill. Add to that the fact that we had some cancellations, and it leaves fairly substantial problems. Again, you hit it right on the head. This is a difficult problem, and it is a problem. But all we can do is try to muddle on.
Sure. Mr. Chair, did this change occur with the change in the state conservation
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, I don't know if I could answer that, whether that was the change that occurred or if it would have been some of the federal budget issues and sequestration and some of those things that we're going on to. I think we're going to
Well, I just wanted to say that maybe my recollection isn't so great, but I remember hearing for the last couple of years that it's all dependent on the farm bill, that we don't know how that's going to come out, and even if you weren't told that, anybody should know that. And negotiations in process are not a promise. Anybody who believes they are has to think again. I don't think that this is your creation. I think this went from federal leverage of 178 to 43%, and 160% to 3%, and you know the second one is obviously worse. You know, I scored you really, really highly. I think you would have been in the door making your play for the money anyway in your presentation. I don't know that I would have given as much, but that's all water, over the dam. And so, what do we do now? You know, we do have a 43% match is nothing to sneeze at on the Minnesota Laws 2012. That's very, very good. It might be the still the highest one in that round of applications. I'd have to dig out my, records or yours or something. But I don't know. Do you think we should deny it? There's still a hell of a lot of good work being done here.
Tom, did you hear something?
There's been mention in the presentation of a letter and a resolution. And do we have those?
I don't think
Mr. Chair, we were under the impression that they were going to be in the packet. Apparently, they were inadvertently overlooked. We'd be happy to provide all of you with them.
Mr. Chair, they were also attached to our amendment request. But it was our understanding that they were going to be included in the packet. So I apologize if I was referring to documents we don't have.
I would just like to add one other thing, that I'm not in favor of extending any completion dates. I think we have to, you know, cut our losses, make progress, and look at each year as they develop. And this is unfortunate. It's not that you know, dissimilar from the previous situation we talked about. Is that this is a moving target. All of these financial considerations that we consider, it's not something that's guaranteed. A lot of these things are not guaranteed. And things change. Commodity prices change.
I think the dilemma for me on this is sort of the precedent that it sets of hearing proposals based on a match. And then seeing less conservation than what we agreed to for whatever circumstance. You know, how do we treat everybody that comes in that says, well, I meant to match, but I couldn't find the money, so give me a score for best efforts. You know, I don't know what to do. I'm very concerned about that. I am convinced internally that if this proposal had come to us with the matches that are indicated, they would have probably been funded, but at a lesser level. And so what we really did was to take money from other people doing valuable projects and allocated it to something because we felt we were going to get more conservation for it, which isn't now happening. And how is that fair to the others that were trying to do good work? And what criticism will we come under? Bowser knows that they were slow in getting these projects done, which is part of the problem. But what exactly we can do at this point and how we avoid being in this circumstance in the future is really the question I think we ought to be asking ourselves. Because if someone comes to me and says, you know, here's a $100,000 project and I'm going to make $200,000 worth of value, and you give them the money and then they came back and said, just kidding. And they do it over and over and over, you're in a tough place in terms of our credibility in doing conservation. And so I really think we need to think about what do we do when someone promises a match and doesn't deliver it going forward. Because I don't think we can fix the going back. This is a circumstance we can't fix. But we really, before we get to our next RFP, have to think about what do we do when people don't meet their commitments. And if we did that and said, there's a hard line here. You know, you got 10%. Of a number and not make the match, or you don't get the money. Kind of thing. I was part of an accreditation decision not to accredit a land trust in Wisconsin, and subsequently, it turned out they had falsified documents to the Department of Agriculture on matches. And they said, you know, if we get $750,000 from you, we'll get $750,000 from someone else to do this project. And they made up the $750,000. And it almost put them out of business, and they had to pay the money back. And that was the consequence of it. And everybody who plays in that world knows the consequence. We have no consequences to promising a match and not coming back. We need to establish consequences. I'm prepared to go forward with this, but I do think we have to address this going forward because you're not the only ones that have been in this position. You didn't try to create the problem, but the reality is conservation that we thought was going to get done isn't getting done. And our business should be to force that conservation to be done. Sue?
Two questions. One, is there any procedure for us to say, you know, for you guys to offer a pro rata reduction and give back some of the money so we can use it somewhere else? And the other thing is, how much did you actually get done for the laws of 12 and 13, and how much is left in your pot of money?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe Mr. Penning is looking at the numbers we have left. I guess, you know, as to the, well, let me just first say to the comments, Mr. Chairman, that you made, too. I think that is why going forward we will do this differently. I think we have learned our lesson about tying RIM to a specific federal program that may or may not be there. From now on, we're going to call it RIM. It's new, you know, RIM Wetlands. And if we can match to a federal program, that will be great. But I think we're not going to tie it specifically to that. You know, I suppose we could come with a pro rata share. I wouldn't know how to go back and say how much, you know, might we have gotten if our match was only this amount and what's fair. I mean, the reality is we will still put conservation on the ground. If the dollars come back to the council and have to get reallocated, it will be conservation on the ground. I guess I would ask what's gained by taking the time to do that other than I understand you're trying to address a fairness issue. So, you know, we're open to a constructive solution here, but I'm not sure I would know how to specifically come up with a pro rata share.
But in answer to your question, it takes legislative action to undo the appropriation, or we cannot approve an accomplishment plan, and so it can just run its course and be money sort of hanging out there, which is never spent, and when it runs out, then it would come back to us. Those are, I think, the two options, unless Bowser itself wants to turn it back prematurely. Rick?
I think this does follow up on the previous discussion, too, that understanding the accelerated land values, prices that are going on, and although they should be coming down, they're not necessarily doing that.
Everybody still believes it works more than they are.
Still fast.
Sure.
So, so again, as if folks want to drive out in the country right now and look at the bulldozers in action, go out and see them. And the tiling and the plowing and the wrecking. So, I mean, I think if you've got the landowners and you know, you can sign a RIM contract, saving some is better than saving none, which is what we get if we have to come back. And I want to follow up on James' point. The issue is 12 and 13 were before the farm bill. And the statement, and this is words do matter, the statements of when the farm bill is being debated and what will happen on the farm bill in the future farm bill is different than under existing federal authority. As Trowan did mention, we've had these discussions, not in this one, but with bonding as well. And we've handed out the fact sheets as well. I've handed them out from Bob to committees. So that's the point. And that's just that. We can vote to go forward on this. I think the second item is clear that we have to do that. And I don't see much choice on the others, but it's not a good thing.
Okay. So, following up on that, Rick, and hopefully the whole council would agree, can we put on our agenda for early in the year, before we put out an RFP, the discussion of how we handle promise and consequences to promise, so it's clear to everyone going in what happens when you don't meet your promises? For reasons that are beyond your control or within your control. But if we're going to make funding recommendations based on what we believe to be a level of conservation, they should be real. And if they're not, there should be some consequence of that, I believe. And if we can put that on the agenda for early in the year, I think that would be a wise discussion, unless someone thinks we should. Jim?
Thanks, David. I think the other issue here, though, David, is that it's not just that this happened, but we kept marching into the pit because we were assured everything was going as it should have. I wouldn't have as much heartburn if we were only talking about 2 years here, but
we kept going deeper and deeper and deeper on the assurances of people that things were going as they should. And that's where I have a big issue here. Is nobody came forward after a couple of years and said, you know something? There might be some glitches here. You know, we might want to temper things here. That's not what happened. We kept getting a cheerleading squad and how great this was and how everything was going. And we kept going, sinking deeper and deeper and deeper. And that's where I have the issue. Somewhere along the line, bells should have started going off that, you know, what was being promised wasn't happening, and we should never have gone any deeper than, you know, 1 or 2 years.
And that's why some of the work that staff did to show the status of these programs that are going on, you know, year by year by year, now that's coming to be very, very helpful, because at this point, you know, now that we're a fifth into this whole 25-year exercise, you can start having a report card that's showing, are they meeting their obligations? And one of those is time. And we've talked about that in our RFPs before. That's one of the things that gives me a, you know, uncomfortable feeling, is these projects that go on and on and on for 4 years, 5 years. I mean, the council, the whole council can change in that amount of time, and memories are short even when you're on here year to year. And so there have to be these, you know, report cards that we're all aware of, and that's our job. You know, that's our job as counselors to say, are they, it's not just the obligation of matching, because matching isn't the only thing we're looking at here. It's one of the things we look at in when we're doing our evaluations. It's not, it, and it does weigh in on when we're making our money appropriation recommendations. It's true. And I'm, you know, I'm kind of heartbroken over the whole thing too, like everybody is. And I'm sure nobody's more so than Bowser. But, you know, it's not just leverage. It's not just time. It's accomplishing over time and all the work that staff has to do to track these projects. And that's one of the reasons I encourage shorter terms rather than longer ones. And that's why I wouldn't vote for extending any completion dates on any of these prior years' work that's been done on any project or program.
So do you want to make a motion?
I would need some help in writing the motion, but my intent would be not tinker with the completion date, acknowledge that this is a bitter pill and we can't change things retroactively, but it'll certainly make an impact in forward thinking and forward approvals, forward recommendations.
So, can I clarify your motion?
Please, David.
You would move that we approve the revised accomplishment plans for ML 12 and 13 by Bowser, with the as recommended in the packet we have, with the exception that the completion dates not be revised.
Correct.
The rest of it will be under revised. Any discussion? Discussion, right?
So if as the staff, if we did that, then with if someone signs an agreement today, they would have to complete the acquisition easement and the restoration activities by June 30th, 2015 on a 12 project.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, the acquisition of easement would need to be completed. I believe the language allows some time period beyond that to complete the restoration.
And as staff, would the existing statute of allowing 4 years for the restoration still apply so that they could get that done? What this would force is the contract to be completed. Acquisition.
Chair Rick, I think so. I think the issue I'm having here is
these dates were to go beyond what's in the law, each of these appropriations have to be and I think that the issue here would be to not, I don't think they could have, you could have approved anything beyond that because that's in the law. So the question is do you want to just leave it the way it is in the law and not change the dates at all? Now, some of these accomplishment plans may be sooner than what the law provided. I don't know that. Mr. Becker might know that better than me or somebody from the staff here. But I think what we probably want to do is just approve them as provided in the law. And then so whatever they can fit into the law, they can do.
That's what I meant, sort of, I think.
Thank you for the clarification. Well, Mr. Chair, the point was, I think you could have extended it anyway, because the law specifies how long we're available.
Right? Ironically, the federal funds would be the extension.
But Mr. Chair, Bill, we're showing no federal funds.
Mr. Chairman, just to be clear, that was our original request. We're not asking for any extension of timelines. We believe we can complete the acquisitions and the restorations within the timelines that are in the law.
Okay. Any discussion? Yeah. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for helping us through this difficult situation. We appreciate it.
So, you have the accomplishment plan, which is agenda item 8, which is the same thing except leverage goes to 0. You want to make the same motion?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. We apologize for this letter and attachment. We have a trace.
And we will get those to you.
I would encourage you to get Randall or Matt on.
Thank you.
Item 9 is an information report on the Transportation Partners Program.
Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program, or CPL, is now in its 6th year of providing funding for organizations throughout the state to restore, enhance, and protect our state's prairies, wetlands, forests, and habitat. To date, we have funded 278 projects totaling $22 million. Nearly 77,000 acres have been restored, enhanced, and protected, with another 100,000 acres planned. In your handout, there's a table summarizing each year of our CPL appropriations. This table notes the total grants for each year, the amount that was awarded out, the funds spent to date by the grantees, and also how many projects have been funded each year, how many acres have been planted and completed to date. So far this year, we've completed our first round of the Expedited Conservation Projects Grant Cycle, or ECP. ECP is a simplified application process for projects under 50,000 that are on lands or waters open to all seasons of hunting and fishing. We've received 20 applications in this first round and funded 18 of them for a total of $600,000. At this point, 17 contracts are set up and work has begun. This was our most successful ECP round yet, which means we have only $400,000 left for the remainder of the year. Our second ECP round will close next Wednesday. We are currently completing the review process for our fiscal year 15 round 1 statewide and metro funding. These applications were due in mid-September, and we have a two-month review process, which includes initial staff review, a technical review committee review, a review by the regional directors and division directors of the DNR, And then a final review with the commissioner's office, which we'll have next week. We will be notifying applicants of their funding status by November 24th at the latest. At that time, the award information will be made public. Our statewide or traditional grant cycle received 21 eligible applications requesting $4.2 million. Because we set aside $1 million for the ECT grant cycle, we only have $3.285 million available for statewide projects. So our demand has once again exceeded our available funding. Our first Metro grant cycle received 26 eligible applications requesting $3.8 million, and we have about $3.75 million available for funding. At this point, we don't know if we'll have a second round of funding for the traditional Metro grant cycles, since we haven't yet completed the review process. However, we are pleased with the quantity and quality of applications we have received so far this year. At this time, I'd welcome any questions.
Question? Jane?
Eligible applications, how many or what percent approximately that you receive are ineligible?
We might get two or three total that are ineligible.
Other questions? Jim?
Thanks, David. One of the main purposes of this program was to inspire conservation at, local level, private, or non-governmental groups. Do you have any idea of the proportion of how many goes to non-governmental entities and how many go to?
Mr. Chair, in the past, I think it's been about two-thirds to NGOs. For this current ballot, I'd like to double-check on that.
Other questions? Great. Thank you for coming in. So, members, next on the list are discussions on various rider languages for the upcoming bill that we'll see in final form in December. There were a number of issues that were things staff were going to work on and put forth for us for discussion. They have recommendations for us to begin our discussion on those issues. The four issues that we identified were hang and grazing, NGO donations, CTL and CTL Metro, and federal availability.
Federal funds.
Sorry, I lied. So I think we ought to take them one at a time. And Bill, you guys work on the language. Can you lead us through this?
I'll do my best. We have an agenda item memo that's divided into four parts that addresses each of these. And then there's a general discussion as to what's missing and what not. Grazing language. Language that was cropping languages that was discussed. What we're doing with haying and grazing is taking the language out of the individual appropriation riders and put it into the availability law thereabouts in the bill itself. It will apply to all acquisitions in terms of reducing scope. It could possibly increase the scope, but I don't believe it does. It's all land acquired by with the OHS. And what it does is what we did before, and we don't allow grazing because of a disaster or a disaster declaration. But if there's a grazing plan that's in place, then they continue to use that plan as it finds grazing should be done. We've looked at the grazing plans. They are specific, detailed, the ones we have seen at any rate, and I think protect and improve the resource if properly followed. Donation to NGOs using the Outdoor Heritage Funds to acquire land. This was requested by Representative McNamara. We have language in the agenda item memo, but we also have substitute language, which I believe you have received on a single sheet of paper. It's titled Agenda Item 10B, NGO Donations, Revised Language 1112, and that's coming around now. This was negotiated by staff and legislative leadership council, and I think it would be appropriate to have a little testimony on this one.
I was going to ask for some.
So if we could
allow that.
If we could have the Trust for Public Land come down to the witness stand, I guess.
Not for witness. It's a hot seat today. It's not witness.
And we met yesterday with them and went through what was necessary to make this powerful language. Basically, what this is intended to do is to put an end to the practice of tying donations to acquisitions. So that instead of getting paid for your effort and expenses out of a donation tied to an acquisition, all recipients would operate on a reimbursement basis only, with support services allowed and things of that sort. And it could be reimbursed for anything that you allowed in your confidence. The major focus of this has been the Trust for Public Land, although it affects others, it may affect others. And they've asked to have a few words.
Susan, would you like a few words?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and all members of the Commission. Again, for the record, my name is Susan Schmidt, and I'm State Director for the Trust for Public Land here in Minnesota. I asked Chair Hartwell and Bill if I could say a few words for the record, and so that's my intent here. The rider language in that's before you now, so as Bill described it, it is dated 11-12-2014. So let me just say that the rider language in front of you now accurately reflects the conversations that the Trust for Public Land had just yesterday with Representative McNamara and several key legislative staff. So I just want to start with that and say it accurately reflects our conversations yesterday. So thank you for that. Quick turnaround. For the record, I just really, as an organization, feel it's important to have on the record some of the background, however, and I just want to share that with you today. So briefly, the mission of the Trust for Public Lands is to protect lands and create parks for people, ensuring healthy, livable communities for generations to come. The Trust for Public Land has worked across America for 43 years. We are incredibly proud of our accomplishment. In Minnesota alone, we protected nearly 100,000 acres of important land and water, benefiting literally millions of Americans, of Minnesotans that love to go outside, whether they're hiking, hunting, fishing, or bird watching, or just taking a family out on a beautiful summer day. In so doing, we believe we've saved the state millions of dollars in land acquired below fair market value and transaction costs. The Trust for Public Land board, advisors, and staff, I've shared this with you, so I'll share it again, fundamentally disagree with the premise behind the rider language. We do not think there's anything wrong with seeking donations from landowners to support our work. We disagree with restrictions on landowner donations in principle, in policy, and in practice, and do not view them as these restrictions as positive for conservation or the state in the years to come. However, we recognize that some of the legislature have very different opinions on the same matters. And as a result, after many years of debate and frankly fighting, the Trust for Public Land is very clearly choosing to move ahead, get the discussions focused on our great mission of protecting land for people. For the state, and we don't want to focus on how we get the work done. Accordingly, we've made a decision very clearly to seek reimbursement for our expenses when we submit proposals to the LSORC next spring, 2015, and I'm sure they'll be great proposals. This is apparently how all other NGOs or most other NGOs are here. So in closing, again, the rider language, and if Representative McNamara is on the phone, that's great. The rider language before you today in this revised language does accurately reflect the discussions we had yesterday. I'll stop here.
Great. So I would just say this is clearly a compromise between what the Trust for Public Land would like to do and what many people have felt was a better practice. I just want to say I'm appreciative that the Trust for Public Land has done the great work that it's done and has listened and tried to find a good compromise that it can live with and just get on with the work. Thank you.
I'd like to echo those remarks, and I also want to just say that I think to some extent TPL has been unfairly targeted. I don't think that picking out one piece of the whole financial package in terms of what we do here and what we recommend to the legislature is fair. If they've got matching funds that, you know, triple ten times more than whatever that amount is that the landowner is involved with, all of these things have to be taken into consideration. I think it's nitpicky. The other thing is, I don't want to be a nitpicker on this council in terms of trying to make everybody exactly the same. We need diversity in our partners, and we need partners that can get deals done with landowners that come from all different walks of life, and not one size fits all. And so, you know, this is, to me, is a smaller issue than other people think it is. The other thing that I'm concerned about is language that would impact or reflect a negative, unduly negatively influence a possible bargain sale in the future. I don't want to walk away from future opportunities by writing with such a sharp pencil that it's eliminating possibilities for great conservation in the future. And I don't see anything in this language saying that bargain sales would not be exempt from this prohibition. It says the prohibition shall not apply to donations that are not connected with the acquisition transaction. What about bargain sales as defined in the Code of Federal Regulations? I'd like to see something worked on there too, but I appreciate the compromise that's been made. And I won't repeat what I just said again. I already said it.
So, excuse me, I think that's a request by a member to come back with a little bit of a rewrite in the next year.
I don't want to tie our hands or anybody, any of our partners' hands in jumping on an opportunity that's a bargain.
That's fair enough. It's a good suggestion. Jim?
Thanks, David. I don't know if Representative McNamara can hear us, but I would like to hear the argument as to why forcing the Trust for Public Lands to move to this different business plan is the best thing to do. If we have an acquisition now, say for $1 million, and that's basically what the Trust for Public Land does, is acquire land, and the land's appraised at $1 million, if the DNR buys it, it's going to cost us $1 million plus the 8% or whatever their number is, another $80,000 in expenses to acquire that land. If the Trust for Public Land purchased the property for $1 million, we have no additional expenses. So I don't understand the purpose behind this proposal. it seems like it's counterproductive, and I'm not quite sure why it's being promoted.
Jenny, are you on the phone? Apparently not. So if you can't respond right now. Ron?
I echo Jim's comments. Unless I'm missing something here, that there's been some skullduggery underneath the table that I'm not aware of, but others are. To me, the fact that the state is sticking its nose into an agreement between a landowner and another party regarding how the finances will be done is inappropriate, because it has nothing to do with the public money that's been utilized here, as best I can tell.
I don't want to speak for Denny, but I will give you what I have heard and Susan has heard for many years, which is essentially the Trust Public Plan business model creates a commission structure, asking the landowner to provide a donation based on the value of the transaction they negotiate with the state, in some cases exceeding what their costs are, which goes into the general funds when this money is specifically for the project that's at hand. And if you can negotiate a donation, why not negotiate a better purchase price for the parcel and let us reimburse you your real cost? Because then it's transparent, we know what it is. And that's what the argument has been for at least 10 years that Trust for Public Plan has been fighting in the legislature. And frankly, I've spent most of that time listening to Susan and others with the Trust for Public Land talk about it. It's incredibly frustrating for them to defend themselves. This is a way to get out of being in a defensive mode constantly, look forward instead of trying to defend something that becomes invisible. And that's the real, I think, the invisibility of what they're being paid becomes challenging somewhat. And how does the state know it's getting the best deal possible? So that's what the arguments have been over and over and over, and it's been very difficult for Trust for Public Land, which is why they've come to this place of finding a middle ground so they can put it in the state. Scott?
So, obviously, we're dealing with these issues. Are we going to have one motion at the end to adopt all of these?
This is advisory because this is going to go into our bill that we will see in December. What we really want are any comments and feedback and suggested changes or anything else. And if there are none, it will appear in the bill. If there are, then we'll have to modify the bill that's coming to us.
Thank you.
Jim?
David, I understand your recent comments, but what do we care? If the cost of the parcel and it's an appraised value is going to cost us $180,000, somebody else can use one business plan, $1,080,000 one business plan and $1 million the other way, why would we take the most expensive plan? The extra money, the person who receives the money dictates what happens to it. They're not necessarily going to give it back to the state. I mean, this is just like an envy, the politics of envy. They think somebody's making money off us. Well, I got news for them. Every other NGO out there is showing corporate sponsors, rich donors, all the work they're doing with public money and getting them to underwrite things, make large donations. If people think that other NGOs aren't profiting off this public money in other ways, I mean, they just got their heads in the sand. And why we're going to go along with it, court legislation, a court business program just to ease a few people's whatever, and cost us money. It's ridiculous. It's going right back to the Curry Bank. We're going to do something stupid because it got, you know, passed through legislation. We're just sticking our head in the sand here. Why should we be part of it?
I think we're going to be part of it whether we like it or not is the answer. Scott?
As you said, Mr. Chair, you know, I concur with Mr. Cox's assessment. If it costs us more money, it doesn't seem like it makes any sense at all. But the issue comes down to is the Trust for Public Lands is tired of fighting the fight. This is a compromise that they have come to some form of satisfaction with, not necessarily, no one, in a compromise, nobody gets 100% of what they want. But it kind of comes down to is that even if we have really strong thoughts or opinions to the otherwise, it's their decision in order to make their life easier going forward. And I think we should honor their decision if that's what they've ultimately chosen to do.
So we had in the middle of that discussion passed out a revised version, which I'm told added language at the bottom based on feedback from the Nature Conservancy that covered the bargain sale issue. And I don't know what 26 CFR da-da-da is all about, so I assume they do. But this would cover the bargain sale issue.
26 CFR is the tax code. I haven't read it in a while.
You're very knowledgeable.
I would assume it does too, but I couldn't. I'm sure you know more than I do.
And I think this does what was requested. So it will be in the language.
Okay. Susan, thank you very much.
So there are two pieces of legislation dealing with the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program. The laws of Minnesota, the first one is an amendment to the laws of Minnesota of 2014, Chapter 256, Article 1, Section 2. And it's amending paragraphs M and on the back side of the proposed amendment, paragraph N. And as you will recall, we divided up the administrative money unequally, or not pro rata between those two programs. This basically lines that up. And you can see the changes by the review line and lighter color underline and strikeout. Then you also have an email to Amanda Brazee, from Amanda Brazee, that has a Grant Wilson email attached, and attached to that is Minnesota Law's 2015 appropriation language recommendation. And the desire of council, as staff understood it, was to not have two separate programs, Metro and Allstate, but to have one divide the money in the one and give the authority for some transferring of money backwards and forwards based on demand. And that's what the unnumbered or lettered paragraph is. So, discussion on those?
You know, I understand, you know, it cuts their paperwork in half. You know, there can be some value in that. My question would be on the second one, is if they combine the two and then have the option to move money back and forth, would they have to come to the council before they could make those transfer shifts?
Mr. Chair, the council has them put the accomplishment plan in together in a way that identifies how much is going to which one. Yes, they would. If it were not separated into two different programs in the accomplishment plan, then they would be much freer.
I mean, I would support their ease of paperwork, but we need to list that in a way that if there's going to be any substantial shift from one pot of money to the other, that that has to come through us. Can we make that? Can we add that as part of that? Can we make that?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
It is part of the process.
Well, we need to make sure we notify them if that's our intent.
Yes. So are there any other comments on the conservation department's language?
Mine's on Hayden Graves.
Yeah, we can hear.
I didn't understand the reason we're going to an overall Hayden Graves instead of putting an individual appropriation.
Mr. Chair, Councilman Cox, the force and effect is the same. The visibility is different in the legislative process, and it doesn't stand out so much, I would say, is one way to put it. It was perceived by the agricultural community that the more times it was said, the stronger it was, but that's not the case.
But doesn't it make it easier for them to remove it off the office?
Well, they'll remove it.
They have to remove it from each individual.
Yeah, they would. Having been on the hot seat on this, I don't think it matters how we do it. If they don't like it, we're going to see it removed once or removed 20 times.
In one motion can remove it 20 times.
But it was incredibly visible in every, when we put it in every single appropriation.
To the point of causing misunderstanding, I think.
And they saw it as attacking instead of as just something that was intended to be a conservation practice.
So the last item before we get to the general discussion is federal availability extension. This is the current language that allows the extension of an appropriation if the accomplishment plan or program manager can show at any point in time the existence of a federal grant that's tied to the expenditure of the money. And this became an issue when staff extended and recommended the extension of a $2.5 million appropriation on a $2,000 federal in-kind grant request. And the legislative leadership was interested in seeing language that tightened that up and made it not quite so loose and easy, so that people at the last minute weren't going out because money was about to expire and getting promises of federal availability or federal grants. And so we have provided suggested language that would go into the availability section that says recipients must have confirmed federal match by the time the first draft accomplishment plan is submitted in order to extend the availability of the Affluent Heritage Fund. And this ties into the earlier discussion of match as well, the one kind of match.
One thing that can we add if we're going to try to fix this, can we add that the federal match has to be a certain percentage of the grant? I mean, so we'll say that they truly do have firmly committed $2,500 on $7 million worth of appropriation, and that extends their availability of funds for years, okay? I think if we're going to have a federal funds match, and if we're going to utilize that to extend the availability of funds, we should set at least a minimum threshold of what that, as a percentage, of what that federal funds match might need to be, 10% or something that adds value, because even if it's ironclad $2,500, okay, and we're saying if it's ironclad, it would still extend the appropriation, okay? But it's not enough value to keep that money not on the ground for two more years. So I love the language, we should enact it, but we should add on there that federal funds match, in order to extend the appropriation, has to be at least 10% of the appropriation to make it worth waiting to do the work.
Mr. Chair?
unless nonpartisan staff wants to correct me, that's something we can do. It's a policy matter with regard to that.
And I think 10% would be right on.
Everyone comfortable
with that? Well, the problem is that if you got $1 million appropriation and $100,000, mm-hmm. that's measurable. Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't want to lose out on a $100,000 match. Okay, so 10% to me is enough to make it valuable, and most of our appropriations are $1 million or beyond.
You could say 10%. If it doesn't work, you can come back and change it. It's a good starting place.
Okay,
I would offer.
So we will revise to take that advice into effect. So that leaves us with other things that people are interested in seeing in the bills.
I have one, and I don't know. Bill told me, you know what? You told me to put this in number 11, not in 10, didn't you? My variation from request to accomplishment plan, is that in 11 or 10?
Accomplishment plans would be 11.
Okay. I'll wait till 11.
Well, Rick isn't here, but he wanted to have a discussion about agricultural use of land. Since Rick isn't here, Elizabeth, why don't you go ahead and start?
Okay. Thank you. On page 2 of each of the accomplishment plans, there will be a statement under crop. And under that, there will be the statement is, will there be planting of corn or any crop on OHF land purchased or restored in this program? And then, if so, then you have to explain. And then also another item where it talks about genetically modified GMO trees. And in looking through all the accomplishment plans, there are 5 out of in EA in the soil acquisition that have this, that yes, there will be corn or somebody crops and not. And several of those would use genetic GMO treated. They all explain by saying planting of corn or other crops may occur as part of the restoration plan to prepare the seedbed for native grass and forb species. Now, when there is 5 under PA, prairie acquisition, and actually there's 1 under wetland acquisition, which I find kind of puzzling, but with all of these, if you add up the amount of grants, you're talking over $25 million worth of grants. So we're talking about maybe just 6 projects, but we're talking about 1/4 of the money. And I think I'm very concerned about this. Some of you know I have a farming background. It isn't extensive, but it's enough to know that not only is there concern about corn and depletion of the land with corn and all the problems with water consumption, fertilizer, chemicals, and all, but also that there are some significant problems with Roundup Ready corn, and I believe that this is what GMO in most of these cases are talking to. There are a number of agronomists that are saying we're really going down the slippery slope on that one. So I find this real disconnect between what we're about and actually what these projects are about. Because all of these projects state that, well, many of them are accelerated. They want to get everything on the ground fast. They want to get things done. They want to get prairie back. They want to either restore it or maintain it, whatever. And yet, they're going to take a year to put a crop in there, to till the ground, and do all the kinds of things that we are complaining about in the preliminary parts of the proposal. Why they're asking for money in the first place? Because everything is going to pot with all this corn we're raising. Now, I think this is a disconnect, and I find it kind of hard to swallow, and I think the public will find it kind of hard to swallow. And so my recommendation would be that that we not allow this type of cover to be used. There are many, many other ways to prepare both solid land, grassland, even gravel pit land, to be able to prepare it quickly and very well for native seeds. In the meantime, we did it in a year earlier. Now we've got pollinators that we're serving. Every time we take that year out and take that extra year for seed prep, we really do have a year that we have lost. And pollinators, most of them don't even live that year. So I think we probably need to rethink this. And maybe my proposal would be that we strike that language, that we don't even have that under cost. Maybe we take that out. I don't know what the FM Council feels about that, but maybe take that out. And in the meantime, ask all these folks, DNR did not have that in any of their requests, by the way. These are all NGOs. Ask all those folks, put their heads together and give us a list of best practices. How can you prepare land for prairie grasses and forests quickly, efficiently, and with the environment and all of the other critters? Following the pollinator best practice statutes, all of these different kinds of things, how can you do this? And get a list of best practices that we're able to look at in the future when we're looking at these different proposals. There is one other in here that really bothered me quite a bit, because it is in Bowser. The DNR did not ask for it to be able to plant corn, but Bowser has, under their easement program in PA07, the buffers for wildlife and water, they state in there that a landowner, and I believe these landowners are getting up to around $8,500 an acre in easement, that a landowner can set aside some of that and plant food plots. I think food plots kind of translate to row crops in some cases, corn in some cases. I find that that's probably not a good use of the tax dollars. We'll put money into that when we are thinking row crops are going to be in the middle of this buffer. Even though they say not many people use it, I don't think that that's an argument. And the other thing would be, we really are looking for public hunting and fishing opportunities. And what are we doing allowing folks that we're paying land for, what are we doing allowing them to put in food plots that they will hunt privately, public's not allowed. They're going to hunt privately and draw in critters from other people's land. Is that even fair? I found that one extremely distasteful. But I just think it's something that we need to address, because I do believe it's a disconnect between what we're preaching and what we're practicing. So thanks for hearing me out here.
All right, Elizabeth, thank you for that. I just want to clarify, you're speaking specifically about the accomplishment plans, but the question that you're raising is about whether or not we should probably, beyond the accomplishment plans, address that in the language of our bill that we'll submit to the legislature in early 2015 for our recommendations. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. You are correct.
All right. Scott?
And I had an opportunity to visit with Rick about some of his concerns regarding, quote, crops, okay? And he was under the understanding, and I told him that my opinion, that his understanding was incorrect, that when one of our NGOs or the department goes out and buys a piece of property, that they'll farm that piece of property for 3-4 years before they finally decide to get it planted to native grass. Okay, I've done 20 of these in the last 10 years. Okay, that's never happened. The only opportunity that I have seen where a piece of acquired property was farmed for more than 1 year was where the seller had a contract with someone, and when the entity bought it, they had to honor that contract. Okay. Now, the ones that I know of, for example, that were 2 years, the ground was in corn, the normal rotation would then be beans the following year, corn the third year. And all of those contracts said no. If you're going to farm for 2 years, you're going to go corn on corn in year one, go to beans in year two, so that we have a suitable seed bed for native grass plant. And so I've seen it. We've worked with it. You know, there are situations where if the conditions are terrible bad, that you might see it go for 2 years. But it's a 1 year deal. It truly is in preparation for getting a soybean rotation into that, so you can plant native grass in. And so I don't see a big restriction requirement needed here. The only thing I would say is if we're going to ask or we're going to deal with that is, does the cropping extend longer than the minimum amount of time necessary to put it into a... I mean, I can tell you that there isn't a DNR area wildlife manager that wants to plant native grass into a corn stalk. They don't. Okay, it doesn't work. You'll spend more money, and your outcome will be poorer as a result. Okay, and we actually took one cornfield that was no-till, so there's no ridges in it, and we lit that on fire, and they planted into that when they were done, and that worked. That was the only example of planting native grass into corn stubble that, in my opinion, worked. So I don't think, I mean, when I talked to Rick and he said, well, he thought they were doing corn on corn on corn for 3 years before they planted it. In the 20 acquisitions I've been involved with from a variety of different partners, that's not happening. So I think the only thing we need to do is ask them in the accomplishment plan, is it going to extend longer than the minimum time necessary, seasons necessary, to get it into a soybean rotation? He talked about doing oats. And he talked about doing some other crops, you know, in preparation for getting it ready. I said, there's no one out there to do it. Okay? If you buy a piece of property and it's got 80 acres of crop ground on it, you say, you go run around the neighborhood and say, plant that to oats. You can't find anybody to do it. Okay, you have to utilize the people and the equipment and the cooperative farmers that are available, and they're not going to plant turnips and radishes or whatever else you might think might work. It's going to go corn and beans till it hits beans, and that makes the best grass. So I don't think this is a big issue as long as it doesn't extend beyond the rotation it takes to get to a soybean setup so we can plant grass. And he was satisfied with that explanation when we were done.
And that's just to get the nitrogen fixing from the beans?
It's to get the soil primarily in the right condition,
yeah,
with no little amount of refuse, you know, it's, yeah, nice and level and soft and
the natural...
Get the atrazine out of the system as,
yes,
well.
I would like to hear from the project managers before we did anything different than what's in their accomplishment plans.
So the accomplishment plans are a separate issue, and this is advisory. These will come back to the council after, not in December, but in after the bill is approved in the spring is when the final accomplishment plans come to us for approval.
Okay.
So
if we added language to our bill that said any cropping on lands acquired by funds with the Upper Hedge Fund would be for the shortest period of time necessary to, would that do that? Would that solve our problem?
It would solve our problem for the recommendations that we're going to make to the legislature in January that would take place starting July 1st, 2015. The accomplishment plans would not, that we have in front of us today, would not be covered. No, I'm sorry, it would be covered. The past accomplishment.
Right.
My ears are screwed up a little. Ron?
Well, let's see now. We're going to decide how the land manager manages his land. We're going to decide how often, how long he plants food plots for whatever purposes. And there's nobody at this table who's ever sat on a tractor, I don't believe.
I did once.
Well, once.
That's sad.
I mean, really. I don't you think as a council we should let the professionals know how to manage the land? There is several places for food plots in wildlife management. The definition of habitat itself is a place to live, eat, and reproduce. As I said, there are places for food plots. Scott mentioned just one of them. Managing, setting the soil for other types of plants. We mentioned it earlier in this, where we use food plots to bring deer, for example, off private land that might be damaging their crops and feeding on public crops. This land that we acquire is open to public hunting. I can assure you, if you don't have some food around, you'll have a lot fewer pheasants, for example, songbirds, or whatever you're interested in. I don't think I have any right to be sitting here playing game manager. And I would not support this in any way, any mention of it at all.
Just to clarify my point, I was not referring to food plots in any fashion. I was only referring to someone's concern that tillable acres acquired in a WMA that would be put under some form of manipulation until it can be planted. That would be the shortest period. But no mention or negative implication in any fashion to food plots or their use. Okay.
So, I don't want to debate the food plot thing.
Come on, David.
It's so much fun. I do think Elizabeth brought up a really interesting point about properties that have food plots that are private, that remain private in terms of easements, where a public entity or a nonprofit doesn't own it, but a landowner retains the land and there is an easement that is in place to protect the habitat long term. To allow food plots, which then can be used to induce hunters to come in and pay for the right to hunt on that, to me seems a little far-fetched, and I think it's probably not the right thing for us to be involved in. So I'm willing to let the food plot issue go at this point, but I do think where you have easements, to have food plots allowed in property that has easements on it is very problematic.
David, it's my understanding the easements are not open to public hunting anyway. So if he puts corn there and he hunts it himself, or he doesn't have to let anybody hunt it. So there's nothing gained there. But if he's creating some more pheasants, because some of them are going to fly over to where I can hunt them, so I get a little advantage. And all we have to do is look back at the federal CRP program, where you spent and I spent a lot of our tax money paying farmers not to plant anything, to provide grass, which produced a lot of pheasants. That same landowner could turn around and charge you to hunt there. So we've been down that road before.
I think it's a different road, but I don't disagree. And the CRP, we all know, temporary easements did us no favors. Jane?
Are those temporary easements that we're talking about?
No.
Are these permanent easements? That they would have had the acknowledgement that this would have been comprehended in the original purchase price, right? Just like when we were talking to DNR about it. The purchase price of the easement would be reduced if there was going to be agricultural plots. Would that have been contemplated in the original conditions of the easement?
Bill,
the
do you
want to price?
Answer that question for us?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Bill Penn, for a lot of resources. So the discussion about food plots on easements, I think, could use some clarification. We do allow food plots on rim easements. It's been a long-standing policy to do that, but we do have some caveats that go along with that. First of all, it's 10% or 5 acres, whichever is less, so there's not huge amounts of food plots out there. We do not pay for the planting of the food plot, and when should the landowner stop using it as a food plot, they are required to restore vegetation, permanent vegetation, at their own expense. They're also required to leave anything that they plant standing over winter, so in most cases there's nothing to harvest there. So we see this as an opportunity to provide food for wildlife and also to meet some of the landowner's objectives. We also find that I actually wrote it in the accomplishment plans that that Betty was referring to, but I can't remember the exact number, but it's something like less than 2% of landowners choose to use food plots. So we don't see this as a big issue. We see it as an opportunity to provide food for wildlife, and we see it as an opportunity to meet some of the landowners' objectives, which may be the reason that they wanted to enroll in the RIM program in the first place, because they wanted to hunt.
Is it calculated in the valuation of the property?
The easement is taken over the whole parcel, so there is no reduction for that. But again, it's very limited in scope, and when they are done using it as food plots, it needs to go into permanent conservation cover.
How long can they keep it in food plots?
They can keep it in food plots as long as they choose to.
Bill and David, I think probably the conversation here has taken a little turn that I did not intend. What I'm trying to say is that with native plants, and same with Ron, native plants provide a great deal of food. I mean, we weren't going to have corn in this country when we had huge amounts of deer and turkeys and everything else, all sorts of birds. So obviously they can eat other types of crops other than corn and soybeans. And my my point is, since we are claiming that we are trying to get prairie native grasses and forests on the ground, and it's very important, and we're trying to take ag land out of production that might be vulnerable land or whatever, because what we are going on it is a monoculture and not near as diverse or beneficial to wildlife, actually, as what we're looking at planting, I'm saying, why isn't this information out there, and why aren't we encouraging people to plant natives? Because when you go and look on the list of natives, you will find that just type in deer food forage, and you will find a huge number of natives that deer eat, that turkeys eat, that a variety of birds eat. Now, that the row crops have a whole lot of problems with, and we shouldn't be encouraging row crops when we can put permanent cover on that has as much food value, if not more, and for more diverse species than what we are presently having when we go to this other system of food plots. I think people have a mindset that in order to have a food plot, you need to raise some sort of an agricultural product. That's not true. Start looking on the internet and start looking at what all the different types of critters eat, and you will find that they do very, very well. They're very prone to go to a lot of natural food. I'm just saying, why aren't we using those?
You want to try to answer that, Bill?
Well, I could provide some additional information. I'm not sure I have an answer entirely for that. But one of the issues is the seasonality of the food source. A lot of the natives are available summertime, early fall. Food plots, particularly corn food plots, stand in deep snow and tend to be a food resource through the winter that is accessible to wildlife. And frankly, food plots, whether you like corn or not, planting corn in food plots is a standard wildlife management technique that's been used for decades.
Jim?
Well, now we got Mr. Sheriff fired up. I want to keep Sheriff going. But, you know, it seems, by the way, I own 10 tractors. But here you, when we're doing these burns now, large burns, it's my understanding they make them leave a portion of those native grasses unburned for the pollinators. Now, if you come in and grow genetically modified corn right next to that, which is supposedly the big issue with pollinators, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, you've got the cause and cures, you know, right next to each other. So I would think there's some issues there, especially with that genetically modified corn, and they're putting that on WMAs with we're trying to promote pollinators. That's one of their biggest enemies right there.
One interesting little point, we were talking about, you know, food plots for in WMAs. We actually received like 40 bags of traditional corn that wasn't GMO, and we literally almost had to throw it away because nobody would plant it. Nobody. Not anywhere. Not for free. Okay. So we can try to do other stuff, but at the end of the day, that is going to be more difficult than you might find it to be.
And why would they plant it?
Because everything they do, you got to empty the planter, you got to put this stuff in, and it's different than the stuff you had. You got to vacuum out the seed boxes, okay? And then you got to spray with a different kind of chemical that you're not using.
There's hundreds of floral planters.
I'm talking about trying to find somebody to do it is more difficult. I have one. Go and use it.
So. We can do nothing, or we can address the issue. It's clearly an issue that's not going to go away, and it's going to come back time and time again. And I think the GMO thing is we have state requirements of working on pollinator issues, and GMO is not the good thing for pollinators.
We've got pretty good consensus on all of them except that one. Can we move the ones that are there and keep working on the last one?
Absolutely.
That's my recommendation, because I don't think we're going to get it done today on that issue.
I'm not feeling we are. I'm asking. My feeling is the same as everyone else's.
I think we should do that.
Because Ron and I probably will never agree on this issue, and we're still going to smile.
You will come around to my way of thinking.
I don't think I'll come around your way, and I know you won't come around to mine. But I do think we should at least think about the pollinator issue as we go forward, maybe for the next round, for how we address that specific issue. Because that's different than just food plots generally, especially related to pollinators. So,
out of curiosity, can we just throw out a recommendation to the grant requesters that they consider whether there's a different way to do what they're doing, including leaving the GMO completely out of it, so that when their final accomplishment plans come back, maybe we only have to deal with three or four that have an issue, and the other four got fixed by the grant proposal?
That would certainly be a reasonable strategy to go back and say, if you can take the GMO side of it out, we would appreciate it.
Yeah. And see if they'll do it voluntarily.
Okay with that? Not a mandate, but a request. Okay. Staff, I'll ask you with that. The rest of this, is everyone comfortable with the language that would be inserted in the bill for the balance? Good. We'll add that to the bill, and you'll see it in December when we approve the bill. Last on the list.
Progressing the action accomplishment plan. And Sandy had a brief presentation, I think.
And that's great. I want to say before you present anything, Sandy, the memo that staff did, the issues that they noticed in the accomplishment plans was incredibly helpful. I mean,
a lifesaver.
Incredibly helpful. I'd like to believe that we're all really good reads and we would find all of this stuff, but we don't work with it the way you do, and that you would have spent the time and give us this to work with is deeply appreciated by the chair and I believe the rest of the council.
I guess I'll just say that I thought all the accomplishment plans were in very good order. The things identified in this table were, for the most part, just minor technical issues, some of which we've been able to address by simply doing a quick little IT fix in our online system. I will draw your attention to the parcel list issue, which affects 9 of the programs, and staff is just asking for council guidance on how to proceed because it's been an issue addressed at past council meetings on wanting to location of where the work is going to be done. I'll draw your attention to that. In addition, to speak to Scott Rawls' issue on the federal funds, at the December meeting, we can pull a report off the system that will address which programs have said they have federal funds, what kind of funding is it, how much it is, so you can look at that when you determine if you want to add that rider language into those programs. And then also I will say that this was an administrative oversight on our part that we did not round these to the nearest 10,000. So we still have some thousands of dollars hanging out there, and we plan to address that at the December meeting when we get a forecast revision from MMP.
Okay. Thank you. So what do you want to do about parcel lists?
Well, for one thing, some of the programs don't have parcel lists until they get the money, and that's when the sign-up periods start afterwards, so it's impossible. But what I wanted to see was their selection criteria. And I don't know what else to do other than look at their selection criteria and maybe, measure them up and see if anybody has any other comments on them.
In cases where there was no selection criteria attached and they maybe had just indicated a general list of counties, would council like to see something more specific?
I'd like to see a criteria selection process documented somehow. Yeah.
The cost involved here is in the presentation of what we are recommending, and those programs that have criteria lists aren't represented in the mapping. And in some cases, in the distribution, proper distribution of the acres and things of that sort. I think you bring up a good point about timing. And what would have to happen is that we would have to encourage more and more applicants to accelerate their cycle so they come to us with applicants, lists of applicants. And we've talked about that in the past, so I'll just leave it at that.
Scott? I have one other question slash issue regarding, but not directly to Sandy, is Sandy's presentation.
I would hope that we would take the work that staff has done, led by Sandy, and expect to see the issues that you've identified addressed in the accomplishment plans and provided versions. And that would be adequate direction and thanks to you and direction to the grant recipients. If that's all right with everybody.
I didn't understand what you said.
The issues that staff identified on this list would be addressed with the individual recipients who would address the issues and modify the accomplishment plans that were sent out to encompass, to take into consideration and clarify the issues that are in here.
Okay, and additional issues then?
If there are issues that weren't identified here, we bring them up. But
now or?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, because I got a lot of them.
Okay. Well, Scott wants to go first. So.
Well, I would defer to Jim. I only have one.
No, bring it on.
My issue, and I don't know how we fix it, but when I took a look at, I actually went back out the old book, flipped open number one, number two, looked at their accomplishment plan, number one, number two, and one recipient said, we got half as much money as we asked for. So you look through and you look at their acre delivery, it's half. You look at their expenses, it's half. You look at their direct support services, it's half. Okay, I got that. That's pretty easy for me to understand. And then I go to the next one, and all of a sudden when they asked for $9 million, they had $6,000 in contracts. They got half of $9 million, and they got $180,000 in contracts. okay? Some big change in that accomplishment plan from the original request. And so what I would like to do somehow, I mean, unless we're going to sit and go line by line on every accomplishment plan back to every request, okay, and see if what's not prorated, okay? Now, not some expenses aren't going to prorate exactly. I mean, I understand that. But we have to have some method, and Bill indicated that they might, so that when you submit the accomplishment plan, if one item in your proposal is not prorated by, say, more than 10 or 15%, then you have to explain why it's not. Okay, how can you go from $6,000 in contracts at $9 million and $180,000 in contracts at $4 million? And, I mean, I don't think the council wants to go back line by line through every request and every accomplishment plan trying to uncover those discrepancies, but they certainly need in the accomplishment plans to be explained to us or at least distinguished to us why that happened. You know, it's pretty easy. The ones prorated, they look good, you move next. But why would there be big changes without that recipient explaining why those big changes exist? That's the question I have, and I don't know how to fix it.
Well, and the other side of that is that the amount of money went down, but the staff cost stayed the same, and it wasn't prorated. Those kinds, or it didn't go down by close to the same amount.
I don't know how to fix it, but we need to address that because there's a lot of things that are going to get through here unless you expect every council member to line by line every single accomplishment plan.
So what Scott's asking for is a mathematical algorithm put into the online system that identifies disproportionate pro rata between the request and the accomplishment plan. And when it finds it, demands an explanation.
Yes.
Lucy, you got some explaining to do.
Yeah. Well, we can also have a report put through the system that would compare all of those side by side, and staff would look at them and pull out any that don't make sense.
And that would work too. I'm not trying to load up. I'm not trying to give you guys more to do. I'm just, when we need to figure out a way to do it, you guys can determine which is the best
and
way to do it.
I think it's both dollars and accomplishments. I mean, if you get two-thirds the money, are you doing two-thirds the work? If you're doing half the work, that's as bad.
And I saw one whose appropriation was half, and their deliverables only went down 25%. But would they throw out the highest priced ones or something? I mean, I don't know how you do that. But you would have thought that that would have been almost automatic, but it wasn't.
Or they were sandbagging when they gave us the
initial
proposal.
I don't know. I don't think anybody does that.
So is that something staff can do, working with the recipients? To
she does, yes.
I think that would be very helpful.
That was mine.
Jim?
Well, that was all my issues are budgetary issues, so that would solve mine. All my problems.
Again, I just want to thank staff for a tremendous amount of work to get us to the point where we can therefore focus on this important issue. So thank you, Sandy, for heading that up. Anything else for the council plan? Anybody from the public want to address the council? I'm not aware of anybody in advance, but we'll take stand up. Sandy, you want to testify? You're the only one who stood up. Great. We'll adjourn. Thank you all.